Hey, we're back. I'm Michael Cohen. You're tuned into 1320 WILS. Well, the markets appear to have regained their footing after that Brexit collapse, but really, what are we in for, and what's the larger economic state we're in really like? Let's get some perspective from a man that really understands the issue. Todd Buchholz is a former White House director of economic policy. He's the managing director of the legendary Tiger Hedge Fund, an award-winning teacher at Harvard, and the author of the brand-new book, The Price of Prosperity, Why Rich Nations Fail and How to Renew Them. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Yeah. For those who don't know about the Tiger Hedge Fund, how big of a fund is that?
Well, I should point out I'm the former managing director. So the Tiger Hedge Fund was one of the biggest and most important hedge funds. So billions of dollars, let's put it that way. Yeah. But probably more than McDonald's has sold hamburgers, although I haven't checked the McDonald's sign recently.
Yeah. And how did the fund do when you were managing it?
Well, I was lucky enough to be there during the heyday, and it was the founder of the fund, Julian Robertson, is kind of a legend in investing, so I was lucky enough to have Julian as a mentor.
Uh-huh. Was that the 90s then? Or?
Yeah, that was in the 90s.
Uh-huh. And what do you think about what's happening nowadays? Would you want to be involved in the markets today?
Well, look, if you're involved in sophisticated trading, then you like volatility. It's tougher when everything is kind of bland, but these are exciting times. Now, they're treacherous, they're anxiety-inducing, but if somebody is an investment professional, it's much more interesting than if everything is going along in a humming, boring way. The markets are not boring, that's for sure.
But when you're running a hedge fund, you take, what, big positions and kind of stick with them for a while, don't you?
Well, it depends. Every hedge fund's different. There are certain funds that take long positions and say, by God, we've just figured out the Japanese banks are bankrupt, and we're going to hold on and have short positions in them until they capitulate. And then you've got other funds that, my God, they'll buy and trade by computers every nanosecond, and they'll be short banks, long banks, and you never know unless you take an instantaneous snapshot. So simply because something is called a hedge fund, frankly, doesn't give you a whole lot of insight into what it does until you look under the hood or look into the portfolio. Yeah.
Do you think trading nowadays is tougher than it was in the 90s?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's tougher. I would say that as a result of the bubble that took place in technology stocks in the 1990s, and then again, various bubbles that have taken place in the 2000s, I think they've become more dangerous. I mean, just look, it's rather unprecedented. If you think about 1999, you had the tech bubble or the tech wreck. Then obviously you had 9/11. Then you had the housing bubble followed by the housing crash. You had a commodities bubble followed by a commodities crash. These bubbles are just coming on at increasing speed and frequency.
Are we in a bubble right now, do you think?
I wouldn't necessarily say we're in a bubble, but boy, the idea that interest rates are virtually 0%, that a 10-year treasury is less than 1.4%, I'm highly suspicious that if we scroll the calendar ahead 5 years, that interest rates will be anything like 1.4%. But
what do you think? Where do you think they'll be at that point?
Well, I would hope, for the sake of the world economy, that interest rates become a little bit more normalized, and that 10-year rates, instead of being less than 1.5%, are, ready for this, twice that. Now, that's rather remarkable, twice that. So, in other words, if interest rates doubled to nearly 3%, that still, in historical terms, would be remarkably low.
For long-term investors, should they be feeling good about the market Brexit reaction at this point?
I think the Brexit reaction was overdone, at least on the equity side. And as I point out in my book, which you mentioned, The Price of Prosperity, we have entered a time where countries are looking in the proverbial mirror and deciding, who do we want to be? Mm-hmm. Are we Brits? Are we Americans? Are we just some multicultural United Nations melange? And so I think when that vote came, it announced to the world that countries are really questioning globalization. Now, the U.S. economy is not terribly vulnerable to Brexit, but there's some folks who thought, my gosh, if Brexit could happen, then, well, Donald Trump may become president here. And obviously half the country thinks that's a dreadful idea, and maybe half the country thinks it's a good idea.
Now, talking to Todd Buchholz, the brand new book, by the way, The Price of Prosperity, just out last month, Why Rich Nations Fail and How to Renew Them. When you say the price of prosperity, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that lots of people have written about countries that are poor, that fall apart. And you can read about Syria or Sudan and other poor countries. Very few people have written about rich countries that have fallen apart.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I should point out that right now on Amazon, The Price of Prosperity is ranked number one among books about government history. So,
is there a negative consequence to prosperity of some kind?
Yes. So here's what happens when countries become prosperous, they threaten to unravel. Why is that? Well, here's one simple reason. When countries get richer, and this happens throughout history, going back to the Spartans, for God's sakes, when countries become richer, people have fewer babies.
Mm-hmm.
So then you've got fewer young people, and so then you must rely more on immigrants. Well, if you rely on immigrants, that can be a wonderful thing if the immigrants are integrated into society. But if they're not, then you have a culture that begins to splinter. And I fear that's what has happened, obviously, within the UK and within France, and possibly it's happening right here in the US. So it is a consequence of prosperity that we have this more multicultural country. Now the question is, can we cohere in a multicultural era?
Okay. Is there an example of that being done successfully?
Well, I think for the first half of the 20th century, the United States did a remarkable job taking in tens of millions of immigrants who became proud Americans, who took up baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one reason that was able to take place is there was great diversity among immigrants. There was no single immigrant group that dominated. In fact, in the early part of the 20th century, Germans constituted the largest group, but they were only 17%. So you weren't going to get very far in American society if you merely, you know, drank Rheingold beer, spoke German, and ate knockwurst.
How does that compare to today, would you say?
Well, today, clearly, we've had a predominance of Hispanic immigration, now more recently Asian immigration, but arguably we need more diversity among immigrants so that those who come in do not feel as if they can spend their lives simply kind of living off of or acting as if they're still in their home country.
I'm curious, though, if we do need the immigrants, how do you think we should handle the illegal immigration issue then?
Well, I don't think we should permit illegal immigration.
Okay.
And I think we need to look hard at legal immigration.
Okay.
So in The Price of Prosperity, I point out that we should invite more legal immigrants,
mm-hmm.
but we should especially invite those who have skills.
But
who
the,
have
all,
education.
All the illegal Hispanic immigrants, do you view them as being a negative to our prosperity at the moment?
I certainly think there are many illegal Hispanic immigrants who are actually contributing to U.S. society. But even if that's the case, the question is it good for a country not to have control of its borders? And I think the answer is no. A country is entitled to control its borders, and the U.S. should do that.
Talking to Todd Buchholz, the brand new book, The Price of Prosperity. What's the greatest threat to our prosperity in the U.S. right now, would you say?
Well, when countries become wealthy, the work ethic begins to decline. There was a review of The Price of Prosperity in the Wall Street Journal on Friday. I was very grateful for the review, and it quoted one of the lines, which is, when a country becomes prosperous, everyone gets a comfy bed, mm-hmm. but there are fewer reasons to get out of it in the morning.
Mm.
So I worry about labor participation. I worry that there are millions of Americans who wake up every morning, look in the mirror, and say, work, a job, well, it's not really my field.
What do you say to those that believe it's an issue of opportunity, that they simply don't have the opportunity?
Well, here's the issue. There are opportunities throughout the country. There may not be opportunities in one's hometown or one's home state. And so I think, therefore, and in the price of prosperity, I argue that government policy should make it easier for people to move. They should get mobility credits and other incentives so that if they're living in a place with a very bad job market where their plants are closing down, they should be encouraged to move elsewhere. One of the characteristics that made America great was mobility, that people were willing to, you know, strap up the station wagon and move to another place, whether you're talking about the Okies, you know, and John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath or something more recent, or the Beverly Hillbillies, people move. They don't do that anymore.
Well, here in Michigan, we saw a huge outflow of jobs over a decade ago, but they're coming back, not to where we used to be. What when you look at individual states like our own, what's the key to bringing jobs and prosperity to a state?
Well, if you're a company deciding where to locate, certainly you want an educated, hardworking populace.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in a state or a community that is known for having good, educated workers, if you've got a strong community college system or even better, a university system that attracts hardworking people, then that's a real advantage.
Well,
secondly,
part of the issue, too, we have a Michigan State University here in East Lansing, but a lot of times the graduates leave Michigan as soon as they're done with school, too. So I guess it's tricky to get them to stay sometimes.
Well, and then you have to look at your tax system. Texas and Florida have not had too much trouble attracting people. I live in the state of California, and the Mayflower moving vans are empty on the way in, and they're taking people out to Texas because the tax rates are lower. There's there's booming business, which then gives the government enough money so that they can repair the roads. So California and some other states have been, Connecticut, have been stuck in some cycle where they thought, well, let's raise taxes so that we can give people more benefits, but it turns out that scares people away and they don't get the benefits or the people.
Well, one last thing, Todd, you talk about work ethic. How do you get, especially this young generation now that may be comfortable even living at home with their parents, how do you instill that in them?
I think we've made a big mistake over the last 20 years in discouraging kids from getting summer jobs and after-school jobs. Now, as someone who's been an academic, I can't tell you that you can learn a lot working in the frozen food department of your supermarket. You know, sure, would it be better to take a course in Shakespeare or algebra? Yeah, academically, but you know what? If you get a job while you're in school, it teaches you the discipline of showing up, and it teaches you how hard adults have to work in order to put food on the table.
Why is that not being passed down generationally, though? Why don't we see parents instilling that?
Because parents think, and this is not a stupid idea, parents think, and I have to consider myself one of those parents who thought, you know, gosh, why have my kid work in the supermarket? Yeah, she'll learn a lot more if she takes a summer course. But then you have to ask yourself, are you building people of character? Are you building people with the grit and the confidence that will become successful adults? So I think, you know, you could say, yeah, we coddled our kids too much, and there's something to that. I don't think it's because we were bad people, but I think there are consequences to coddling and consequences to shielding children from the hard work that adults must do.
Well, what do you think about having an unsatisfying job to make you understand why you want a more satisfying one?
Well, I think that's fine. I don't think it should be indentured servitude. I don't think people, you know, I don't think a young person should be stuck, you know, hauling coal or crawling on their belly into an old coal mine. I don't think there's much good about that. But the discipline of showing up at work at the Dairy Queen or the McDonald's, nothing wrong with that.
We've just scratched the surface a lot more in the brand new book, The Price of Prosperity, Why Rich Nations Fail and How to Renew Them. Todd Buchholz, former White House Director of Economic Policy. Todd, thank you very much.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
And we'll be right back with more. This is 1320 WILS.